Last weekend, was it last weekend? Yeah, it was last weekend. £18 million was spent by Britons on Valentine cards. £34 million was spent on Valentine roses. And for just £17,000, you could have had a Valentine special weekend at the Scotsman Hotel in Edinburgh. What did you get for your £17,000? Well, you got a bath of pink champagne. Not sure if it was to bathe in or to drink, but you got 120 red roses. You got a helicopter flight. You got a personal chef. And you got, just two nights in the penthouse suite. I thought it might have been a year, but it's just two nights for £17,000. And some people took up the offer. And all of that is evidence, I think, of the kind of erotic orientation of our society. Many things are sold in our society by their attachment to sexual attraction. Music, chocolate, cars even. One of the sad things about this is that we've become obsessively narrow in our definition of love. Do a word association game with a random sample of people this week. You know, I say fish, you say, I say salt, you say, and drop in the word love. And I'll almost guarantee you that the word they respond with will either be sex or a word associated with it. I was looking for some pictures tonight, to put up here on love. And I typed in love in the, picture bit. And this is what you come up with. Now, I don't know if your computer is any different from that, but every single one of them carries this connotation. That's the only thing the laptop there knows and associates with the word love. Of course, it's a laptop programmed by our culture and our society. And being part of that cultural drift has many problems associated with it. For example, a fair amount of marriages that get into difficulty and indeed break down do so because people's sexual experiences simply don't live up to the unprecedented expectations that they have of them. And so they go and seek the unattainable elsewhere. But it also has problems for us as Christians as we read the Bible, not least here in 1 John. 50 times in 5 chapters, John uses the word love either as a noun or a verb. And what John is meaning can be seriously misunderstood because we have narrowed our definition of love so much. Take, for example, what he says in the next chapter. Famously, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him. Now, it would be not unusual in a Bible study group with that to be read and to be asked, what's that about? To hear someone say something like this, oh yes, I've experienced that. Sometimes in my quiet time, I'm just bowled over by Jesus' love. It reduces me to tears. Jesus is so wonderful. I feel as if the whole room is bathed in his love, and probably, for all I know, pink champagne as well. Now, what that person is doing is hearing John's use of the word love from within a society that has eroticized love. And so they identify and interpret a rapturous experience in their quiet time with what John is talking about. Now, let me make it quite clear, there is absolutely nothing wrong with this person's experience. I'm sure it's a very genuine experience of the grace of God towards them and very significant for them. But what is wrong is their interpretation of 1 John and the basis of that experience. That's not what John is talking about when he speaks about the love of God towards us or our love towards others. You will, I'm sure, know that there are, or there were in the Greek language, 4 words for love. C.S. Lewis has famously, among others, made those words known to us. There are three of them, I think, yeah?
Are they?
Yeah. It would have been possible for John to have used the word eros here in this book from time to time, because it was not a word disassociated from a religious experience in the world in which he was writing. In Greek mystery religions, it was the very word used to describe the emotional release which mystics enjoyed when in a state of religious ecstasy. And indeed, various writers and thinkers in different Christian traditions down the centuries have employed what we would call eros language in their thought and in their hymnology. I am my beloved's and he is mine is language taken straight from the Song of Solomon and employed by us in some of our songs in a kind of eros type use for our relationship with Jesus. Jesus, lover of my soul. We often sing either in an old hymn or a modern song, and again it's kind of eros-like language. And there can be experiences of Christ's love that are so intense that there is little other language available to us to describe it except what we might call the language of eros. But despite its availability to him and his familiarity with it, John uses another word right through this letter, and that is the word agape. And he takes that word, which people say was a kind of rather empty and featureless word, and he colours it with a very specific picture. This is how we know what love is, he says in the passage we read tonight. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. That's love. And that's the love of God that I'm talking about. And that's the love to which I'm calling you. And if we are to live out what John calls us to hear in this chapter, we need to forever associate the word with this picture. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. This is love, as John speaks of it. And we want to look tonight at the character of this love and the consequences of it, I think, under five headings. The first thing to say about it, as we seek to take up what John calls us to as believers in the Lord Jesus, followers of him, is to say this, that love suffers. It's a rather strange interlude in his writing here at the start of the passage we read tonight, and a rather strange illustration that he gives of Cain and Abel. Theirs is a very poignant story, really. It's quite shattering to realise that the first baby born in the Bible turns out to be a murderer, and he murders his own brother. Why? John says to us, because his own actions were evil and his brother's were righteous. It was Abel's righteousness, his faith and his acceptance by God, that evoked in Cain murderous hatred. And John says to us, now the righteousness of life to which you are called, which we were reminded of very powerfully last week, will evidence itself in love. And you know what? People will not come out onto the pavements of the street where you live and applaud you for that. In fact, genuine godly love has an enraging effect on all who are not of God. So if you're going to be committed to this call here, to love as Christ has loved, prepare yourself for this. Don't be surprised if the world hates you rather than loves you when you love. Love suffers. John's not saying anything new here. He's simply repeating what Jesus has already said back in the 15th chapter of John's Gospel. This is my command, love each other. If the world hates you, he goes straight on to say, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. Back in John 3, where love and light are characteristically brought together by John, you know, famously, God so loved the world, and then he goes on to speak about light. Jesus says this: everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. And that's partly why people respond in the way that they sometimes do to a display of love, because it sometimes shows up their own heart and exposes their own life. Now think about Jesus' experience in this regard. You remember, don't you, the story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery, and Jesus' actions that release her and send her on her way. An act of love. And the response? By the end of the chapter, it says they picked up stones to stone him. No applause, no praise, no well done for this act of love, but rage and hatred. Or Jesus at Matthew's dinner party, when Matthew calls round some of his work colleagues and associates, Matthew chapter 9. Jesus spends time with them, and then coming out from there, he meets Jairus and goes to heal Jairus' daughter, and then the woman to raise Jairus' daughter from death, and then the woman who's been bleeding for many years, and he stops to help her, and then the blind and the mute. And the reaction to all this love, it is by the prince of demons that he drives out demons. Not applauded, not praised, but ridiculed. And I think the experience of men and women down through the ages has been, as Jesus said it would be, very similar. I was reading at Christmas the biography of Cardinal Winning. You'll remember a few years ago that initiative he had to help teenage mothers who didn't want their babies, and the offer, if they didn't have them, to abort, that the Catholic Church would provide adoption homes for them. Well, you and I were probably aware of that offer, but you're probably not aware of the vitriol that was inflicted on him and those who worked with him to make that a possibility for people. Was it anything other than an act of love to keep a baby alive, to help a teenage mother in the difficulty? But they received more vitriol for their act than applause. I remember reading the story of a church in South Africa 20 years ago now, I suppose, at the height of the racist tensions and system and institution that was South Africa, of a church that decided to cross the barriers that were there, went out in service of some of the severest poverty in some of the darkest townships. A week after they started a social responsibility program, their church was the victim of an arson attack. Love suffers. And I think that's the first warning word that we have to take from this chapter, that if we're serious about loving the Jesus way, then we need to realize one of the things that will be true of us is that love will bring us into suffering. Secondly, love shares. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Verse 17. This is a very engaging little verse of John's. You see, love is very easy when it's hypothetical. It was C.S. Lewis, I think, who said, loving everybody in a general way may be an excuse for loving nobody in a particular way. And John won't let us away with that. The love of God that is universal in scope is always particular in application. And so not only does the Bible say God so loved the world,
But Paul, speaking of the very same act of love in Jesus Christ, is able to say, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. That which is universal is particularized to an individual. And this is what it means to you and me, for the love of God to take root in our heart. It means, in terms of John's illustration, it means my response to this person in this place at this time in this way. That's the essence of Jesus' Good Samaritan story. Well, who is this neighbour that I've to love? You know, is it just a general benevolence to the world out there and thinking kindly thoughts to them? Well, no, it's that fellow that you walked past on Cumbernauld Road an hour ago, who was obviously down in his luck and in need of help. That's the neighbour that you've to love. It is particular and it's practical. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, John probably has one eye on the Gnostics here again, for whom the physical and the material simply didn't matter because everything was about the spirit. But he has also one eye on Jesus, who took a body and bothered himself with hungry bellies and blind beggars and smelly feet. And I think if John, where he was, could have one eye on us tonight, he would say this sentence to us: in our time, in our part of the church, in our way of being Christian, he would say this sentence very slowly and hesitate over every syllable as he says it to us: if you have material possessions and see a brother in need but have no pity on them, how can you say the love of God is in you? Dear children, let us not love in with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. Many of you will know this poem that was written by a homeless woman who once turned up at a vicarage and was told by the vicar whose door she was at that he was very busy but he would pray for her. And she went away and wrote these words, which were later sent into a magazine: I was hungry and you formed a group to discuss my hunger. I was imprisoned and you crept off to pray for my release. I was naked and you debated the morality of my appearance. I was sick and you knelt and thanked God for your health. I was homeless and you preached to me of the shelter that is the love of God. I was lonely and you left me on your doorstep to pray for me. You seemed so holy, so close to God, but I am still very hungry and lonely and cold. Two other things have struck me as I've thought about these words over the last few days. The first is the possibility, the terribly easy possibility, for us to hide ourselves from those in need. Let me just share with you a personal reflection here. The house that we lived in Port Glasgow was like the manse associated with this church, right next door to the church. And it was a very public place. It was at the top of the hill in Port Glasgow. It was visible from many places, as was the church. I am not dreaming and I am not allowing the past to shape or colour my imagination. But I can honestly say that there was never a week in 11 years living in that house that somebody did not come to our door with some kind of need, looking for food, looking for money, looking for a bed, weekly, daily, nightly. I don't live in that kind of house now. It's not a publicly marked house. hidden house in that sense, and therefore people don't doorstep me. And while I could have read this verse, I think probably with an easy conscience for 11 years, I realise now that often my response was because people put themselves in front of me. But when you live in a private house, and when you travel in a private car, and when you meet with your private friends for lunch, it's possible never